Hello and welcome to Power Pros Podcast, episode 113. I'm your host, the Hoff, Chris Hoffman, and with me is my co-host and nemesis, Pete Michaud.
Good afternoon.
We are back, of course, once again to talk about what's going on in the world of Nintendo. So we've got some new releases to discuss, we've got some news to talk about, and then we've got our big topic for the week, which is going to be discussing the 30th anniversary of the NES classic Mike Tyson's Punch-Out.
Let's do it.
So let's kick things off by discussing Nintendo's recent release, Fire Emblem Warriors, which is out now on both the Nintendo Switch and the new Nintendo 3DS.
Awesome. Have you played it?
Indeed, I have. I have spent a few hours playing through this game so far. Obviously, it is a hack and slash fest featuring the characters of the Fire Emblem series. If you've played Hyrule Warriors or any of the Dynasty Warriors games, then you know the basics. You and some allies are fighting against massive armies and just slashing up everything in your path, often dozens or maybe even hundreds of enemies at once. And yes, this formula works really, really well with the Fire Emblem franchise, as I had kind of anticipated. It works much better than Zelda does, really.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
I mean, it's not that Hyrule Warriors was bad, but because Fire Emblem features a wide variety of protagonists, and it's all about army versus army battles, whereas Zelda is about, you know, one main character, and he's never really fighting armies in the main games, you know, that felt kind of forced.
Right.
But this just seems like a totally natural fit. And Koei Tecmo has been making this series for ages, so all the basics are down, everything's in place. You have your weak attacks, strong attacks, meter-based special attacks, and you can go into a temporary powered-up state. But this one also adds a lot of Fire Emblem-y goodness. For example, the weapon triangle is still in full effect, so depending on whether you're using a sword or a lance or an axe, you have advantages or disadvantages against other characters.
Right.
The same goes for using a bow against flying enemies. Plus, you can give commands to your allies. You can pause the game, go to your map, and you can command allies to send them to different parts of the battlefield. Or you can make them team up with each other to watch each other's backs.
Sweet.
And then you can swap characters instantly by just pressing down on the control pad. So there's this strategic advantage to positioning different characters in different parts of the battlefield. Or, you know, maybe you want to just have guys team up. So maybe you have a sword fighter with an axe fighter and you can switch between them on the fly. And of course, you know, you could do this in the 3DS version of Hyrule Warriors, but not the Wii U version. So it's great to have all these features, you know, in the complete full-fledged console version of Fire Emblem Warriors.
Yeah, it's great.
And when you do have allies team up or fight near each other or heal each other or whatever, you know, it builds a relationship between them. You get some stat boosts. You know, it's not really in-depth like the regular Fire Emblem Warriors titles. You get some generic comments as they bond, but there's not really any dating or marriage in this title as far as I know.
Sure, but that's kind of a cool perk.
Yeah, it's still nice to have, you know, a little bit of a nod to that in there. But really, probably the biggest deal in this game is having all of these different characters from different Fire Emblem games all coming together and having them all at your disposal. It starts with just a couple of new characters, Rowan and Liana. They are the prince and princess of a land called Eitolus. But then you quickly meet up with Crom and Frederick and other Fire Emblem Awakening characters. And then you move on to the Fire Emblem Fate scenarios and meet up with Takumi and Hitomi and Leo and those characters. It's sort of you experience these key story beats from these past Fire Emblem games.
Cool.
And that just continues from there. You know, it brings in the original Fire Emblem, the GBA Fire Emblem, Shadows of Valentia. And the story is pretty contrived in that you almost always have some misunderstanding. It's like, oh, I have to fight these other heroes. And then, of course, they'll team up. And it keeps happening over and over again. It's kind of ridiculous.
Of course.
But, you know, it's fine because it gives you an excuse to have all these characters in a game together. Then they're all on the same side. And then they're like, okay, on to the next task. Anyway, the action is really fun, and despite the added strategy elements, it still ultimately comes down to running around this chaotic battlefield, chopping up everything in sight, and trying to get to the next hot spot and defeat whatever's there before your forces are overwhelmed. I haven't run out of time yet, but they're always yelling at me about how urgent everything is, and you know, it's kind of, you know, crazy and intense.
It's like you when you try to get me on this podcast.
Or when I would try to get you to take a screenshot.
Oh, yes.
But, you know, that's fine. You know, that's the nature of the game. And it's just enjoyable to run around slashing everybody up and trying to accomplish these goals. I guess if there's any complaint I have about the game, aside from the fact that, you know, it can be a little bit repetitive, it's just that there's so much stuff to deal with. You have so many characters And, you know, after you're a ways into the game, it's like, oh man, I have so many characters to try to keep leveled up and try to manage and try to get them all good weapons and stuff and decide who gets priority. But, you know, I guess that's kind of a good problem to have. You know, I'd rather have too much of that stuff than too little.
Right.
I've mostly been playing the Switch version of the game, which looks great, but still has, you know, a little bit of unsightly pop-up on some of the enemies. And, you know, because there's like, you know, 100 or 200, 300 enemies, you know, fighting against you at once. So that can tend to happen. But I've also played a little bit of the new 3DS version, and it plays pretty darn well, too. I mean, there are fewer enemies visible at once. But other than that, it actually seems pretty close to the Switch version. I didn't really notice any performance issues in the early levels I played. And, you know, it's not in 3D, and you do have to have a new 3DS or new 2DS system to play it, but it is a perfectly suitable substitute if you don't have a Switch to play this game on.
That's cool.
At least from what I've played so far.
They must have an engine now that they just, you know, they use for Hyrule Warriors that they're now using for Fire Emblem, and makes it relatively easy to put on both consoles.
Maybe, but Hyrule Warriors was a big step down on the 3DS, I thought.
Really?
It really took a performance hit big time, but this one does not.
Oh, that's good to hear.
So they've really managed to polish it up and improve it, and you know, things are a lot better this time. I think, you know, making it exclusive to the new 3DS family of systems has really helped them get the most out of the system.
Yeah, it's like the super expansion pack.
Yeah. Of course, alongside the game, there are new Fire Emblem Amiibo.
Amiibo!
That's right. Crom and Tiki are both now available. They have the same brick-style base as Celica and Alm from Fire Emblem Echoes. So I've got a nice little collection of Fire Emblem Amiibo going.
Mm-hmm.
Crom is pretty great. He's got this dynamic, swishing, and tattered cape that's sort of like going around his shoulders. And that's a really, really neat touch. And there's lots of little details in his armor. And his face looks really good, too. And I like the way that he's posed and, you know, sort of showing off the Falchion sword. It's not, you know, super obvious that's what he's doing, but it's, you know, very, very prominent in the pose. So I really like this amiibo.
And when you look at it, do you ever go, Crom?
Sometimes I say, by Crom, but but that's it.
Fair.
I'm not quite as enthused about Tiki since I'm not really familiar with this version of the character. And I haven't reached this incarnation of her in Fire Emblem Warriors yet. But she still does have a lot of great detail, especially this, I'm not really sure what it's called. I'm sure there's some official term, but it's like these giant tassels that are coming off her waist and partially wrapping around her, and they look really cool. Her face is a little weird, like it kind of looks like she's about to go to sleep. But other than that, it's a pretty nice amiibo as well.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing I will say about them, though, is that their in-game use is pretty weak. In this game, you can only use 5 amiibo in the game per day, and mostly they just drop like random weak weapons that don't really seem to be too much better than the ones you can get from just fighting in a regular battle.
Hmm.
I guess you are supposed to get, you know, some sort of special weapons from these two, but even so, they don't seem, you know, significantly more useful than just your standard weapons. So it's really at the opposite end of the usefulness spectrum compared to like the ones from Metroid Samus Returns.
Right. Speaking of, I picked those up the other day.
Ah, excellent, excellent. Yeah, those are really useful in-game. These are absolutely not. So I would say, you know, get these amiibo if you are a Fire Emblem fan, not because they do cool stuff in the games.
What if you're just like a crazy amiibo fan like you?
Well, there's always that to consider, yes. Yes, indeed.
A kid the amiibo fan.
So yeah, overall, I am really enjoying Fire Emblem Warriors. I think it's a blast to play, and you know, if you're into, you know, that sort of crazed action, absolutely check it out.
So, Chris, I've never gotten into the, you know, Warriors series at all. Would you tell me whether it's like, should I play Zelda or Fire Emblem?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the answer I would tend to give would be whichever series you are more into, because I really think that's what makes these games interesting. I mean, you can get kind of tired of just hacking up an endless stream of enemies. So, you know, if you're really into Zelda, that would make, you know, Hyrule Warriors the choice. If you're really into Fire Emblem, that would make Fire Emblem Warriors the choice. But as far as the play mechanics go, Fire Emblem Warriors, I think, is, you know, far and away much deeper and much better than Hyrule Warriors. So if you're trying to decide, if you're on the fence, I would say totally go with Fire Emblem Warriors.
All right. I take your word on that.
Okay. Much appreciated. The other game I've been playing recently is The Mummy Demastered on the Nintendo Switch. Pete, have you picked this one up by any chance?
I have not, but it looks amazing. What do you think?
I am really digging it so far. It is a pretty excellent non-linear 2D action-adventure in the vein of Metroid from the folks at WayForward. It is loosely based on the movie The Mummy that came out earlier this year, which I have not seen. But this is apparently what was happening, you know, elsewhere in the movie universe while Tom Cruise was off doing his thing. Tom Cruise is not featured in this game. There is no Tom Cruise likeness.
This is like the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead of The Mummy Returns.
I have no idea what you're talking about, but sure, I will totally agree with you on this point. Anyway, the game is very Metroid-y. Because this game emphasizes shooting, you know, like Metroid did. That's what Metroid does. It's all about the shooting as well as the exploration, the atmosphere. And this game also has that in droves. But obviously, this game is also very Castlevania-y, what with the horror theme and the zombies and the mummies and the bats and the bugs that you're fighting. And later on, there's even like a spinning gear clock tower that's straight out of the pages of Castlevania. Wow. So,
well, I guess if you're going to borrow heavily, you might as well borrow all the way.
Yeah, you might as well borrow from the best, yeah.
Yep.
But I have to say, just from a gameplay standpoint, because you're using ranged weapons instead of melee weapons, it really does feel more like a Metroid than a Castlevania in a lot of ways. And, you know, like these games usually do, you have lots of cool weapons at your disposal. You know, a heavy machine gun, a spread shot, a flamethrower, grenades, C4. And then you get, you know, abilities such as an enhanced jump, the ability to hang from the ceiling, the ability to go underwater, there are health boosts to collect, you know, ammo boosts to collect, you know, other collectibles, all that good stuff is in there. And it has some really, really nice pixel art too. This isn't HD like Shantae. This looks and feels like a lost Super NES game.
That's cool. I kind of got a Contra vibe from it. I mean, it's funny because WayForward made that Contra game, but
yeah,
kind of had that same aesthetic to it. Is that accurate?
Well, I mean, I guess the visuals do kind of resemble that old Contra 4 game they did for DS. And yes, a lot of the weapons certainly are Contra-inspired. You know, you got your flame gun, you got your spread shot, you got your heavy machine gun. So, you know, there's a little bit of similarity there, but, you know, the pacing and the gameplay don't really feel like Contra at all. But,
sure.
You know, certainly there are some inspirations that it takes from that.
Yeah.
But mostly it just reminds me of, like, some of these obscure licensed games from, you know, the 16-bit days,
right.
Like Stargate or Alien 3, where it's kind of
right.
A wonky license, but the game is actually pretty fun. Oh, except they couldn't quite get the full license, so there's no character likenesses. And so,
right.
You know, in this game, instead of Tom Cruise, you're just some generic masked soldier who, honestly, you know, looks like he could have been just some generic cannon fodder bad guy trooper in any other game.
Yeah.
But that's kind of okay. The game is still, you know, really fun, regardless of being just you know, generic soldier guy. And it paves the way to a really interesting play mechanic in that when you die, you don't just, you know, come back to life. When you respawn, you're actually playing as a different character. And the character you were before is a zombie.
Whoa.
And so you have to, yeah. So you have to track him down and kill him because he's got all your items. So it's pretty easy to do. But you take him out and then you have all your stuff back. And then you continue on with the game. But it's an interesting little twist.
Yeah, that's really odd.
And actually, it is a little bit of a problem because there's actually no easy way to heal in this game. You know, games like Metroid have healing chambers and they'll restore all your health at once.
Right.
But this doesn't do that. So what you have to do is, you know, keep killing enemies and hope they drop health, or, you know, keep re-entering a room and destroying boxes in the hope that it'll, you know, give you out some health. And so that can take a really long time,
right.
And it kind of feels just really drawn out and pointless. Like, why don't the save points just restore your health?
Right.
Because, you know, you're probably going to just, you know, keep farming for health before you save your game anyway. At least that's what I did.
Right.
So that's kind of a pain in the butt. Anyway, when you do die and you take out the other soldier and get your stuff back, you don't have full health. So then you're required to, like, go back and farm health. Yeah, I would only get, like, half my health back after I took out my, you know, zombified former soldier corpse.
That sounds like it, like, kind of defeats the purpose, but
It is a little bit of a pain in the butt.
Mm-hmm.
So actually what I started doing eventually after I died a couple times was I would just copy my save file. So that way if I died on a boss, I could just be like, okay, well, I'm just going to load up the other save file as well, where my guy is alive and healthy, and I won't have to go through that process because it is kind of a pain.
Right. So what I'm hearing is you're going to have to farm health at some point in this game.
Yes, yes, you are. And it would have been better if you didn't have to do that. But, you know, it's not the end of the world.
Right.
And it pains me to say this, but there are two other problems.
Uh-oh.
One, there's occasional slowdown, so it really does kind of have that Super NES authenticity. And then there's a crash bug that I kept encountering during the final boss.
Hmm.
And that sucks.
You mean like you'd flex your bicep or something?
There's this move called a phase dash. Mm-hmm. And if I would use that and crash into the ceiling, the game would literally crash. So eventually I just like, okay, well, this move is very useful, but I'll have to beat the final boss without it. And so I was able to do that and finish the game off. But yeah, I really hope that they are able to fix that, because it does kind of suck to be in the final boss fight.
Yeah.
And have the game go out on you.
Phase dash sounds more like a phase crash.
Yes. Yes, it is. But regardless of that, yeah, it's a really fun game. It's a great Metroid-style adventure. And as I was playing it, I just kept wanting to play more. Like, you know, I'd play it like, okay, I'm going to stop after I do this. And be like, no, I'll just have to go explore this part of the map. Oh, just 5 more minutes exploring this part of the map. And it would just keep going on and on, sort of like that.
Huh.
So in spite of its flaws, yeah, I really, really like this game.
That's cool. I'm going to have to check it out.
Okay, let's move on from these game impressions and talk about some news. And this week in the news, we have new systems looking old, we have old series doing something new, and we have digital games going physical, all that and more! So, yeah, the first bit of news I want to talk about is this Super NES-themed new 3DS XL. Pete, I'm sure you've seen this. What do you think?
I have. I love it. It's really cool looking. It kind of got my attention. It was on the homepage of Amazon the other day. Mm-hmm. And they had a great
It's an Amazon exclusive.
Yeah, they had a great little like Mario Kart motif as the hero. Pretty sweet. I saw it and I was like, wow, I kind of want that. But then my pocketbook said no. So
yeah, I totally agree with you. I absolutely am in love with this thing. I really, really want one. I just think it looks fantastic.
Yep.
I'm sure not everyone agrees, but it's basically a light gray system with a pattern resembling a Super NES drawn on the outer shell, complete with power and reset buttons, and then inside it has the trademark purple face buttons. It does include Super Mario Kart, thus the Mario Kart assets on the Amazon site that you were referring to.
Yep.
And you can get this thing with Mario Kart included for the regular price of a new 3DS XL, which is $200.
Yeah. If I didn't own one, I would be super excited, but, you know.
Well, I'm super excited anyway. I really would like to get one, but yeah, you know, ultimately I'm probably not going to, because how many 3DSs does one guy need?
Yeah, I know.
But yeah, it sure does look cool.
Que lastima.
The system is up for pre-order now, and it is supposed to arrive on November 27th. In addition to that, another bit of big news this week, of course, was that Nintendo finally unveiled Animal Crossing Pocket Camp, which is the long-awaited mobile version of Animal Crossing, coming out in late November in North America on both iOS and Android. I believe it's actually already out in some parts of the world, like Australia. The folks in Australia are already enjoying it, but the rest of us are going to probably have to wait a little bit longer, unless we do some trickery with our account locations.
Yeah, I'm probably just going to wait for our version, but how about you?
Yeah, I'm going to wait as well. But the game's looking very interesting. Instead of being a mayor, this time you are a campsite manager. This game is all about camping and customizing your campsite. And it's not like a normal campsite. Instead, you fill it with furniture. So it's like sort of an outdoor party where you've got a couch and speakers and a TV and a bar at this campsite. Or maybe you're going to fill your campsite with toys and bookshelves.
Right.
So it's kind of like an outdoor house. It's kind of weird.
Like an outhouse?
No, not that kind of outdoor house.
Okay.
But you could probably fill it with outhouses as well. I don't know. That stuff might be in there.
Yeah, totally.
And aside from your main campsite, you can travel to other locations such as Lazy Hollow, where you harvest fruit, Sunburst Island, where you will catch bugs, Saltwater Shores, which is for fishing, and then the marketplace, where you can buy stuff. There's also a river and possibly other areas as well. There's a big emphasis on crafting and using the materials that you have gathered or traded to create new furniture.
Yep.
And you now have friendship levels with the other NPC animals. So you chat or complete tasks to raise this friendship level. And then if you do that and you bring furniture into your campsite that they like, then these characters will visit your site.
Cool.
You live in a camper, which is basically a tiny house you can decorate both inside and out. You can add a loft to it. And then, of course, you have the opportunity to sell bugs and minerals in order to get bells and pay off your inevitable crushing debt.
Now, you live in a camper, don't you?
Not anymore. It burned down.
That was me.
It figures. You can also build cool amenities to attract more folks to your campsite, and you can also visit other human campsites, and they can visit yours. Nintendo also promises there will be seasonal events and limited-time items. However, probably the aspect that is on everybody's mind is, you know, what kind of monetization model does this game have?
Mm-hmm.
And it is, of course, free-to-play with microtransactions.
Yep.
So Nintendo says you don't need these items called leaf tickets, but it seems like leaf tickets play a very major role in the game. Like, if you want to build an amenity, it can take 3 real-time days for this thing to get built, but you can speed it up by using leaf tickets. Or you can use your leaf tickets to get some materials you really need. Or you can use these leaf tickets to go to the mine area so you can then mine for minerals. You know, I just wonder, you know, are you going to have to really be using these leaf tickets to enjoy the game, or is it really going to give you an opportunity to earn these instead? Because, of course, you can buy these leaf tickets with real money. It ranges from 99 cents for 20 of these to $7.99 for 200 of these things. So, Pete, what are your thoughts on this? What do you think of the game in general, and what do you think of this monetization model?
Well, the game in general, you know, my big takeaway was that this is almost a full-fledged Animal Crossing game. This isn't just, you know, your little pint-sized Super Mario Run.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think they've shrunk it down a little, but only a little bit in an appropriate way.
Yeah, and then I guess part of me wonders, is this the supplement for a Switch Animal Crossing? I mean, hopefully not for the Animal Crossing fans out there, but honestly, it's kind of a nice middle ground, sort of somewhere in between the 3DS and the Switch. You know, there obviously there's this odd mechanic of in-app purchases, but I mean, hey, let's be honest, that might even happen in a console version at this point.
That doesn't seem very likely. I can't imagine Nintendo forcing you to buy in-app purchases for a full-price game you're going to buy. They have pretty much said that that's not something they're in favor of. I mean, at least not, you know, unlimited in-app purchase. Obviously, they do DLC and stuff.
Right, right, right. I think with Animal Crossing, it is a different story, and I think that this actually does make a lot of sense for them. My hot take on the whole monetization in general for Animal Crossing is that I really think that even if you don't need to buy these leaf tickets at all, the people that I know that are super into Animal Crossing are going to buy them like wildfire.
It seems likely.
And, you know, and that's kind of how it should be. It's like if you want to play this game naturally and you want to just, you know, spend the 3 days to build something, then by all means, please do that.
Well, see, that's where it really bugs me. The waiting the 3 days, that kind of seems a little bit unfair. On the other hand, I think other aspects in Animal Crossing really do lend themselves well to this sort of model. Like, you know, I want to buy some new furniture. Oh, you don't have enough bells? You don't have enough materials? Okay, well, then you can just pay real money. You can get them immediately instead of, you know, doing all the farming for bells and wood or whatnot. And that seems fair. But the 3 days thing does kind of rub me the wrong way.
No, I mean, sorry, I was laughing at you getting rubbed the wrong way. It's just kind of a funny image. But no, I see what you're saying. But I actually, me personally, the way I play handheld games, you kind of want to check in every now and then. And that daily thing, you know, that daily reason to come back to the game, I have to assume that they're building it in a way that makes, you know, you kind of want to play it a little bit every day.
Mm-hmm.
And Animal Crossing's perfect for that. So, you know, I'm hopeful that they're doing it right, and if you don't want to spend money, there's lots of means for you to still play this game and enjoy it.
Well, I certainly hope so, and I'm definitely not writing off the game yet. I will definitely download it. I will definitely play it. I will certainly give it a chance when it comes out. But yes, I'm just hoping that this isn't too ingrained into the game, and that's really the only way you can play it. You know, I don't mind paying for a game at all, but I don't like the idea of unlimited spending one bit. Plus, I kind of worry, oh, you can't progress for 3 days? Well, the game had better be really amazing to make me come back after that.
Yeah, totally.
But yeah, we'll see. We will see how it all plays out, but you know, it's certainly an interesting approach to the game. Probably not wholly inappropriate, but we'll see if it makes for a fun experience or not.
Yeah. Now, I know that one aspect of Animal Crossing is that It is a very resource-intensive game on the Nintendo side of things. It has just tons of copy and tons of localization.
Oh, right. That's true.
And it requires massive amounts of time internally over there. So I do think that this could potentially be the Animal Crossing game for a few years. Who knows? I mean, maybe I'm being a little dramatic, but could at least be a little while before we see another Animal Crossing title. But I think this could definitely hold over fans, and especially if you can get people to play it outside of your normal circle of friends. I think it opens the doors for a lot of fun aspects that you wouldn't get otherwise.
Well, I certainly hope that there's also a new Animal Crossing in the works for Switch. It's been a long time since we've had Animal Crossing on a console, and heck, it's even been a long time since the 3DS game initially hit. So I'll be kind of sad if this is the only Animal Crossing that we have to play for a while, but guess we'll see.
Well, maybe now we can just hope for the Animal Crossing MMO that we've always wanted. Will you get on that?
Yes, I will contact Reggie immediately after recording and demand that that happens.
Perfect.
All right. Also in the news this week, Switch got an update. System update.
Oh, yes.
Now, I haven't really fiddled around with the new features too much, but Pete, what's new in this update, and what do you think?
Well, the big highlights are the ability to now record video as opposed to just take screenshots.
Oh, that's right, but it's not for every game. You actually have to have this feature, you know, programmed into the game, so it works with, like, ARMS and Breath of the Wild, and it'll work with Mario Odyssey, but it doesn't work with most of the games out there yet.
Right, so this is essentially a patch that just sort of enabled it to be available. Now it's up to developers to have to actually put that functionality into their game. Mm-hmm. I actually think it's the right move because, you know, there's going to be some really resource-intensive games out there, you know, Doom comes to mind, where, you know, the developer might opt to not use that feature because, honestly, it might be too taxing, and it might actually hold the game back from being as graphically right, as powerful right. as possible. But then, on the other hand, I read some rumor about the idea that first-party Nintendo games may support up to 5 minutes of video at some point down the line.
Wow.
You know, and you can imagine in a game like Animal Crossing or something where that kind of thing wouldn't be so resource-intensive, being able to rewind quite a bit. So it's pretty cool. And then if you watch, there's a video online where it kind of shows you how you can trim your gameplay and post it online.
Yes, that's true.
Which is mm-hmm. pretty cool.
Yeah, it's definitely a cool feature to have.
We also have the ability to change avatars, swap avatars from console to console.
Well, not just avatars. You can, you know, basically just do a whole system transfer, which apparently you couldn't do before.
Yeah, but it really is based on sort of the account. So if you have, let's say, two people are playing one Switch, you can
right.
Buy a second Switch and transfer said account over to this other Switch. So now you have two separate Switches and one account on each Switch.
Oh, yeah, that kind of does make sense now that you mention it that way.
Yeah, it's kind of cool because, you know, there's a lot of people out there probably, you know, sharing a console. And then eventually when it's time to maybe buy another one, they do. But I think it's a good move because that really enables Nintendo, especially going into the holiday season, to sort of incentivize the reason to own multiple Switches.
Yeah, definitely. Of course, when you do this profile transfer, it's removed from the original system and all associated save files go with it, but it sounds like it's a pretty reliable process so far.
Cool. Yeah, and then I think the other big piece was the ability to use a GameCube controller on your Switch now.
Yes, that GameCube controller adapter that came out with the Smash Brothers bundle on Wii U is now compatible with the Switch, which, you know, nobody was really expecting to have happen.
I also wonder if it would allow me to use my USB adapter that connects four GameCube controllers up to the Wii U and, you know, now hopefully the Switch. I'd imagine maybe. Hopefully that happens.
Yeah, I guess you'll have to try it out and see. But it's certainly interesting that they've added this feature to the system. I mean, I haven't really had any desire to play any Switch games with the GameCube controller, but it's like, man, I wonder what Nintendo might be cooking up. Maybe they have something really interesting in the works that will do this. Or maybe it's just something they put in because they could. Who knows? But certainly the possibilities are very, very interesting.
Yeah, and I think in a weird way, it's almost sort of a sign of the fact that, you know, Nintendo really is listening to fans and seems like they want to be able to do a lot more things than they've done in the past to kind of show support for, you know, its users.
Really? Is this really actually a highly in-demand feature that people wanted?
I don't know if that's exactly accurate, but I think that it's just more of a sign of the times. It's just kind of nice to see.
Well, I'll certainly be interested in seeing where it goes from here. Also in the news this week, there was an update from Atlus about the next Shin Megami Tensei title, which is coming to Switch. They have now revealed it as actually being Shin Megami Tensei V, the next mainline entry in the series. And this series has had kind of a weird history, with the first three being on console, and then SMT4 was on 3DS. And now 5 is coming, and apparently it's a Switch exclusive as far as we can tell.
Wow, are you excited for this?
I mean, I'm excited because I know other people are excited. I've never really gotten into this series that much. But, you know, Atlus does some great stuff. It has a lot of fans around the world. And this is pretty cool news that it's not just a remake or a port or something like that, but actually the next mainline entry. And we still don't know a whole lot about the game. The Japanese trailer was just showing a few clips, you know, a Japanese train station, a bunch of corpses, a ruined Tokyo being attacked by demons, people getting eaten. So just all your, you know, typical Shin Megami Tensei stuff. So there's not really enough about the game to get really, you know, excited about that, other than the fact that, you know, people do really like the series, and it's great to see it coming to Switch.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is this one that you're looking forward to?
You know, I also have never really gotten into that series. I always support Atlus when there's a title that looks like I might enjoy it, but at this moment, I have not broken into that series yet.
Yeah, I think before I play that one, I still need to finish up Tokyo Mirage Sessions on Wii U. But speaking of cool games coming out to Switch, the folks at Nicolas have announced that the excellent platformer VVVVVV is coming out to the system very soon, on the 17th of November. You know, just a couple weeks ago, we were talking about our favorite non-Mario platformers, and this is definitely one of my faves, so it's really great to see this game coming to another Nintendo system and being out there for people to play who possibly missed it the first time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Have you played this one before?
I have. I played the 3DS version, and I loved it.
Yeah, it's really, really good.
Yeah, and, you know, you're actually the first person I've heard say the name out loud, which is kind of fun.
Yeah, apparently the name comes from the pattern that the character makes as you reverse gravity, you know, moving up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down.
It's pretty cool. Yeah, Chris, this honestly just furthers the fact that it feels like the Switch is like the must-own for indie gamers. Like, it's just becoming a home of a lot of indie titles.
Yep, yep. Very much so. And along that same line, in the same vein, the folks at Limited Run Games have announced that they are soon going to be publishing games on Switch, starting in early 2018. They haven't really specified what their plans are, but these guys tend to take indie titles, digital titles, and bring them out in physical form, and that's just really, really cool, and a great opportunity for both players and indie studios.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, as their name implies, the stuff does tend to be, you know, really hard to get and often sells out within minutes, but still, it's something to be definitely excited about if you are an indie fan and a Nintendo fan.
Totally.
All right, that does it for the news. Let's move along into a little bit of listener mail. This first one comes from listener Nick Z, and he writes, "Dear Hoff and co-host, have either of you tried the game A Hat in Time yet? It is a really adorable, funny, bright, and incredibly funny 3D platformer that released on every console except Nintendo Switch, and let me tell you, it's a great time. The reason it's relevant to Nintendo, though, is that it is very much a spiritual successor to games like Mario 64 and Mario Sunshine. Even though it didn't release on a Nintendo system, it is a fantastic game for Nintendo fans. You guys should play it, especially if you like Super Mario Sunshine." Pete, are you familiar with this game?
I'm not at all, but I'm looking at screenshots of it.
Yeah, I look into it a little bit, and so far the game is only out on PC. It is coming to PS4 and Xbox One, supposedly, this fall. But right now it is PC only, and I don't really play PC games, so that is definitely a no on my part. I have not tried it out yet, but it is very colorful. It is clearly inspired by Mario 64 and Banjo-Kazooie and Psychonauts, as the developer has said, and it looks neat, sounds cool. But, I mean, I can just barely keep up with the releases that I want to play on Nintendo systems, so I will definitely be waiting on this one. If it does come to Switch, though, I will totally try it out. It does look pretty neat, so I am throwing down the gauntlet to the folks at Gears for Breakfast. If you make it, I will play it.
But could you please call it A Beard in Time? There's a better chance Chris will play it.
There's a better chance you'll play it.
Yeah?
I knew it. Okay, our next letter comes from listener TJ McCart, and he asks, "Have you ever purposefully held off starting a game because you haven't completed the previous game in the series? I'm holding off on both Fire Emblem Echoes and Breath of the Wild because I'm still slogging through Fire Emblem Fates and Twilight Princess HD." Pete, what are your thoughts on this question? Has that ever happened to you?
I have, but it's very few and far between. It's usually when a game really relies heavily on the story in between one and the next one.
Understandable.
Honestly, the one I would point to is Mass Effect.
Ah, yeah.
The second one came out, and then I played the first one before I played the second one because I heard that that was necessary, and it really was in that situation. I'm really glad that I did do that. By and large, especially with Nintendo titles that don't usually follow a direct linear timeline.
Yeah, it's true.
I have not. I've typically just jumped right in no matter what.
Yeah, same with me. I mean, I don't think I've ever done that. I can't recall that ever happening. Most of the series where I'd really care, I will already make sure I'm caught up, or, you know, maybe it's something that I don't care enough to even bother. plus, when you do this for a job, you know, you got to be timely. So a lot of times you can't afford to wait. And it's like, well, you know, you got to play this game whether you're caught up on the series or not. So that's just sometimes how it goes. However, I will say sometimes it can be motivating. Like, you know, years ago at NP, I really wanted to write the cover story on Final Fantasy XII Revenant Wings on DS. So that really, you know, sort of kicked me into gear, and I made sure I was able to play through all of Final Fantasy XII, which I wanted to play through anyway on PS2. But that was sort of like the motivating factor, like, okay, you're really going to sit down and do this and make sure you're done in time so you can write about this game properly.
Right. Now, my only advice is, you know, to TJ is he is talking about Twilight Princess HD and Breath of the Wild. In that case, I would 100% recommend finishing Twilight Princess HD. I really have a feeling that once you finish that and then go into Breath of the Wild, you will not want to go back to Twilight Princess. Breath of the Wild just kind of has a lot of play mechanics that really are brand new to the series. And, you know, I'm trying to imagine, like, playing Skyward Sword after Breath of the Wild, and it's kind of funny because I'm like, why can't I climb this hill? Why can't I just do anything I want? Why can't I use my parasail? Anyway.
Well, I kind of see what you're saying, but, I mean, they are very, very different beasts. It hardly even seems like they're the same series, seeing how different they are. I'm not sure, you know, he wouldn't want to go back, but they certainly are very, very different titles.
I have a very unfortunate story in which my Wii died, and I wasn't able to recover my Skyward Sword save file.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and I feel like now that I've played Breath of the Wild, I just can't go back. I mean, I would love to say that I will, and I, you know, I want to someday, but that game is so much different than Breath of the Wild. I think it's going to be a challenge for me to go back to it.
Yeah, especially with that Wii Motion Plus control going on.
Yeah. If I wanted to play maracas, I would just join a mariachi band.
All right, that takes care of this week's letters. So I guess we should take an intermission, and then we come back, we will discuss this week's big topic, which is the 30th anniversary of Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. All right, we are back, and we are ready to discuss this week's big topic, which is the 30th anniversary of Mike Tyson's Punch-Out on the NES. This was not the first Punch-Out game. That honor, of course, goes to the arcade game that came out back in 1984. But as far as I'm concerned, Mike Tyson's Punch-Out was sort of the series' biggest claim to fame, and that's where it really made its mark.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, Pete, when we were talking about this the other day, you kind of felt like, you know, with a lot of people, it was the arcade game that's more well known. But, you know, what's your stance on it right now? Do you feel that that really was more well known than Mike Tyson's Punch-Out?
Well, in my circle of friends, no. 100% it was Mike Tyson's Punch-Out was the quintessential Punch-Out game.
Yeah, certainly it was for me.
Yeah, I think the arcade maybe appealed more to like a, I don't know, a more broader demographic, if only because, you know, you'd see it in an arcade and try playing it.
Well, the thing is that I didn't see it in the arcade. I never even knew it existed until after I had heard about Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. So for me, Mike Tyson's Punch-Out was where it was at. And then it was only a few years later, I'm like, oh, this was based on an arcade game that came out a few years before? Oh, how weird.
Yeah.
And I don't think I even knew that Super Punch-Out existed for, you know, even more years after that.
Yeah, to be honest, unless you were really paying attention, you wouldn't really know the two games were related. There was a lot of differences.
So what was your introduction to Mike Tyson's Punch-Out? How did you first hear about it, and how did you start playing it?
Yeah, so I actually first heard about it in the Nintendo Fun Club newsletter.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, pre-Nintendo Power. And I remember seeing it and thinking, that sounds like an interesting game. And at that point, there weren't that many titles for the NES, at least first-party titles.
Okay.
And I remember thinking, this looks worth a play. Well, lo and behold, it was worth a play. It was worth a lot of play.
Yes, I definitely have to agree with that. Now, my introduction to the game, though, was very, very different because I actually did not get my NES until after Punch-Out had already come out. So I think the first time I found out about it was from actual advertisements on TV.
Oh, wow.
Where they actually, you know, had Mike Tyson in the ad, and Mike Tyson basically challenges you to a fight. Like, you know, can you take me on?
Yeah, I remember that.
And then after that, I think I saw that old Nintendo official player's guide where it had strategies for all these old games, including Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. So I got to learn a lot about the game just through that. And I get to see these crazy looking opponents like Glass Joe and Von Kaiser and King Hippo and Bald Bull. But I still hadn't played the game at that point. And to be honest, I wasn't that excited about it at the time. You know, aside from the fact that I didn't have an NES yet, but also it's a boxing game and it's like, well, I don't really care that much about boxing. I really wasn't into sports back then.
Yep.
So it just wasn't something that really excited me. But boy, I was so wrong. I was so wrong. And then when I did get my NES and I borrowed it from a friend and tried it out, I was like, wow, this is really, really good.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that sports thing, because it really, in a lot of ways, it's not really sports related at all.
Right, right.
It's more of an early rhythm game, really, when you think about it.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, I would say, you know, maybe a bit of rhythm, maybe a puzzle game in some ways.
Yep.
But yeah, it really was not like other sports games, because it was all about figuring out these patterns, figuring out when to dodge, figuring out when to block, figuring out, you know, the opponent's tells and being able to react appropriately. And so it really wasn't like you're just, you know, going in the ring and slugging it out. You had a very cerebral aspect to it also.
Absolutely. And the game really let you know if you were wrong in your timing. I mean,
yes it did.
Some of the characters just completely punish you if you just miss timing by, like, you know, half a second.
Yeah. And this is especially true because of the heart system. It was kind of weird because it hadn't been used in the previous arcade Punch-Out games.
Right.
And it's also weird because it was really arbitrary from one opponent to the next. You know, some opponents you'd have like 3 hearts and some of them you'd have like 77 hearts. But this limited how many times you could throw a punch and get blocked before you're totally rendered, you know, unable to fight back.
Right. And then all you can do is dodge.
Yeah, you had to dodge like 2 or 3 punches before you get any hearts back and you can continue the fight. But it really emphasized that, yes, there is this puzzle aspect to it. You have a limit on how many actions you can take. And it's kind of like in a puzzle game saying, like, okay, you must complete this puzzle in 3 moves or something like that.
Right.
So, yeah, it definitely helped the game stand out. I mean, I guess the star system also helped it stand out, that you would use these uppercuts to take out the enemy, and, you know, you could counter at really specific times to earn these stars, which is another very cool aspect of the game.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny that you had to use the start button to actually, you know, execute an uppercut.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, they like ran out of buttons on the controllers, so they made you hit the start button, which I can't really remember another game making you do something like that.
Yeah, just pretty weird. I mean, I suppose they could have put on the select button instead. That almost would have seemed more normal. That was definitely different. Definitely different from other things out there.
Now, Chris, I think the other thing to me that makes Punch-Out stand out, you know, amongst all the other games that came out around that time, was just the the caricatures, these, you know, the boxers themselves were these, you know, almost like cartoony bad guys that,
yeah, very much so,
you know, kind of jumped out of like a, I don't know, a comic or something. It's hard to explain, I guess.
Well, I mean, yes, they had a very cartoony appearance and they were really big on the screen. I mean, yeah. You usually didn't get characters that large on NES games. Now, obviously they use some sort of trickery and they're technically backgrounds and not character sprites, but you know, however they did that, it looked great, and they had just all kinds of personality oozing out of them.
Right, and you look like this little, you know, pipsqueak going against these characters that are easily like yeah. 8 times bigger than you.
Like 2 or 3 times bigger than you, yes.
It kind of felt like this whole, you know, David versus Goliath kind of thing where you're just like, man, you know, I'm never going to be able to beat this guy. He's just like way too big.
Yep, yep, it's true. Yeah, being this underdog, having this underdog story, being this scrappy little fighter from Brooklyn and, you know, climbing the ranks, that was certainly a big part of the appeal.
Yep. Now, of course, a lot of them were horribly, probably stereotypical.
Yeah.
It was definitely a lot of stereotypes.
Yes, yes, there were. Yeah, you would fight, you know, Piston Honda, and he would just, you know, spout out a bunch of Japanese gibberish that, you know, didn't mean anything.
Yeah, but I suppose being made by Nintendo, it kind of made it okay, right?
Maybe, maybe.
Maybe not. Yeah, and then, of course, the notorious Soda Popinski, which I think originally his name was... Do you remember what his original name was?
It was Vodka Drunkinski.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I don't think that was changed so much because it was a stereotype as much as it was, you know, you don't want to talk about drinking on NES games.
I don't know. I think
you're going to drive your young players to go drink vodka.
You know, I think it might have been a combo because the Vodka Drunkinski is probably not so PC, especially not now.
Well, it's definitely more of a stereotype. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So why do you think it is that you know, Punch-Out is so well regarded? Why is it still fun all these years later?
Well, I think there's a couple things. One is the gameplay mechanic of that game still really stands true to this day.
That's true.
You know, you don't really have to do a lot more than just, you know, dodge left, dodge right, block. And then you can only throw 4 different punches plus your uppercut. So, you know,
that's true.
You have a very limited amount of moves.
Yeah, and I guess that's what ended up making it appeal to me as a non-sports gamer, because in other boxing games, you do have to worry about, you know, positioning your character and doing all kinds of other things. And this, it really was just that simple, narrowed down to, you know, dodging, blocking, countering. And that did make it really accessible and really, really fun.
And then I think the other thing is, you know, we kind of touched on this with the characters, but at the time, the sprites still really hold up today. Like, there's a lot of 8-bit yeah. art, 8-bit inspired art that I've seen based on Punch-Out. And, you know, just there's something about it. It's like these characters were big enough to kind of really have some character mm-hmm. without a pun intended there. But no, you know, they're just these larger than life guys with mustaches and, you know, bald heads and giant pectorals with, you know, little 8-bit nipples.
Yeah, it was all very, very distinct. You know, you're not going to forget those particular characters and the way they looked. And I think it really was just that combination of all that stuff, the accessibility, the puzzle-like aspect, the great visual style. It was just like sort of this perfect combination that came along at really just the right time.
Yeah, and then I also guess I would be remiss to say that Mike Tyson didn't play some kind of role in this. I mean, in that point in time,
right,
was...
And that's what I was about to say.
Yeah.
How important was it that Mike Tyson was involved?
You know, it's funny. It kind of came back to bite Nintendo. You know, they did as many things they could do to kind of remove his name from the title.
That is true. And that was a question that we got on our 100th episode about things that were banned from Nintendo Power.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike Tyson was definitely one of those. We were really not allowed to bring up Mike Tyson's punch. I think we got away with it like once or twice, but usually we had to pretend that game never existed. We're like, oh, sure, 1987? Yeah, that was Punch-Out starring Mr. Dream. Yeah. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
Yeah. But you have to owe some credit to Mike Tyson's brand. At that point, he was in his prime. It was the heyday of mm-hmm. boxing. I mean, I honestly don't think boxing has really been to the level that it was when he was boxing. I mean, in that point, I think he was like the biggest celebrity in the world. Mm-hmm. It really made a lot of sense that this game used that as a brand. And honestly, he was the toughest guy in the game. So,
yes, I mean, I totally agree with you. 100%. I mean, the game is really fun, even without Mike Tyson in there, but I think it was his involvement and his personality and, you know, his brand that really made it into a big deal and turned it into a phenomenon. And without him being in that advertisement, you know, sort of sitting there with all those monitors and sort of being like, come on, take me on, I don't think it would have been nearly the hit that it was. And that's why, you know, this is the game that people remember, not the arcade game. I mean, that's amazing when you're a kid to think about that and be like, hey, I'm going to take on the world champion and be able to claim that I defeated Mike Tyson. And it was really a feat worth bragging about, too, because he was just so darn hard.
Yeah, it's kind of bonkers when you think of, like, you know, it makes my mind kind of reel on, like, how did this actually happen? Like, who contacted who? And
yeah, I mean, Nintendo wasn't exactly known for doing licensed sports games back at that time.
No.
It was very, very unique for them. I mean, outside of, you know, Popeye.
Well, that and the fact that it's not really a boxing game, it's like, it's just such a weird sell. And, like, you kind of wondered, how much did he play it before the game came out? And, like, did he mandate that he was the toughest guy in the game? And I just wonder what kind of stipulations he might have had. Like, if he needed to get, like, sign off on his likeness or...
Well, obviously he did, but, you know, Nintendo was at the top of their game back then. They were, like, you know, one of the most iconic popular brands at the time. And Mike Tyson was obviously a huge name, you know, the biggest name in sports at the time. And so, to me, it just seems natural. It seems like, you know, the perfect marriage of two top brands like that, at least, you know, until, you know, Tyson's fall from grace. And, you know, I don't know if the license just happened to run out at that time, or Nintendo was like, yeah, we're going to, you know, distance ourselves from him because of his legal problems or what. But, you know, for those couple of years where, you know, both he and Nintendo were the hottest thing going, it was like, you know, just perfect. I mean, obviously, you know, the arcade games were out, so they could be like, hey, this is what it's going to be, only you're going to be, you know, the world champ, you know, the toughest boxer in the game. So it's not like he didn't know what he was getting into.
Right.
But, I mean, yeah, just seeing his likeness in there, it's like, yeah, this guy really is the real world champion. I'm going to have to take him on. You know, that was very, very appealing, even to someone like me who really, you know, didn't care about sports.
Right. And but I guess back to my point, the logistical problems of, like, showing him his character in the game, how would that even work? Like, send Mike Tyson to Japan or send him, I mean, there, like, the internet wasn't there. Like, you couldn't just email him a picture of what he looked like. It was like they snail mail, send him a picture of the.
Yeah, I'm sure they had fax machines they could have used back then. But yeah,
so.
I would love to know all the behind the scenes stuff. It's too bad.
Yeah.
That they had such a falling out, because there's probably some really interesting stories to be told about that.
Yeah, I bet there is.
That'd be cool. So, do you have any particular personal memories of playing the game that really stand out to you?
You know, I do. I think that my earliest memory of Punch-Out was getting all the way up to King Hippo.
Ah, yes, King Hippo.
And I think he's about five characters in, five
something like
rounds
that, yeah.
in. And when you get to him, he's a different beast, literally.
Yes. Yes, he is.
You know, he definitely required a different tactic on how to beat him.
I mean, he's the most puzzly out of all the characters in the game. I mean, that's where it really sinks in. Yes, this is a puzzle game. You have to really figure out these patterns.
Right.
Just punching ain't going to work.
Right. And, you know, you can kind of fumble your way through the first few characters if you really were just kind of goofing around.
Right.
You didn't need, you know, especially with, like, Glass Joe and Von Kaiser, you don't really need to have, like, a super solid game plan.
Right.
But then when you get to King Hippo, he's just a puzzle. There's, like, you literally are just kind of watching him trying to figure out what his tell is. Of course, once you figure it out, he's very easy to beat. In fact, probably the easiest character to beat in the game.
Not as easy as Don Flamenco.
That's true. But still, he's one of those characters where once you've got him, you kind of got him. But up to that point, he is one bad mamma jamma.
Totally.
What about you?
I guess it would just have to be, you know, finally taking out Tyson for that first and only time. You know, it's a really amazing feat to be able to do it. You know, he's pretty much invincible for like the first, was it like 30 seconds or was it even the full first minute where you can't do anything. You just have to be perfect and dodge his punches and he takes you out in one hit. So I think it was just finally accomplishing that feat. That would have to be my strongest memory because that really does feel like, you know, the biggest accomplishment. You're like, yes, I am the champion.
All right, now you're making me feel bad because I still have never beat Mike Tyson.
But do you remember the code to get straight to Tyson?
Oh, man. Now you're putting me on the spot. I don't know. I don't want to guess, but I think we've got... I bet you I remember four numbers of it. It's like 535 or something like that.
It's 007-373-5963. That'll be forever burned into my brain. Because to be able to take him out, I had to keep trying that over and over and over again. Well, I guess you could consider it that way. I didn't just keep replaying through the Super Macho Man code that you get through normal gameplay. I mean, I earned my way there, but that without that code, I probably never would have done it, that's for sure.
I have made it to Super Macho Man on my own, and I can't remember if I beat him or not. But I've certainly never beat Mike Tyson, although I do kind of swear to do it someday, so who knows? Maybe I'll start up a Twitch stream on it.
Of course, there were other very cool aspects about the game. It was awesome that Mario was the referee, for example. Oh, that's another great touch.
You know, did you ever read the... there was an Iwata Asks about how that happened?
No, I don't think I did, or at least I don't remember it.
Well, I can't remember the exact story, but more or less what happened was that essentially the guy who put him in there just kind of did it without asking anyone. Like, by today's standards, that'd be ridiculous. Like, he would certainly have had to ask Miyamoto at the very least, mm-hmm. and at the very most, probably get a lot of approval. But at the time, it just was like, let's throw Mario in as the ref, and I think he even drew his own version. Hmm. Which is why he looks so much different than Mario's of other games.
Do you think this means that Mike Tyson exists in the same universe as Donkey Kong?
Donkey Kong,
I think it might,
is in the Wii version of Punch-Out that came out.
That's true. So, well, I guess that answers that question, doesn't it?
It's kind of weird. Comes full circle.
Other cool aspects, of course, were those cutscenes where you see Little Mac jogging in his famous pink hoodie. And then the between round scenes where you'd get those gameplay tips and, sometimes stereotypical jibber jabber from the other characters. I was always fond of the one, though, where they do tell you to join the Nintendo Fun Club today.
Those between round little banter back and forth between the characters. I mean, obviously added to the stereotypes in big ways with some of the characters, but it really was kind of funny. And, you know, every now and then there'd be a hint that actually did help.
Mm-hmm. And it was kind of cool. I mean, kind of gross to see them, with the bruises and, getting beat up, but it would really tell you, yes, my tactics are actually working, or maybe they're not.
That's right. So. Even your character would get a little physical damage to him if you...
You get a black eye, couldn't be able to see anymore. Yep. Yeah, it was really, had a lot of cool stuff in there for a game that came out 30 flipping years ago.
Yep.
It's amazing how well it holds up.
Yeah, it's unreal.
So before we conclude this big topic, I would like to go down a list. I would like to put together our top five characters from Mike Tyson's Punch-Out.
Hmm.
Sound cool?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, then. Coming in at number five, we have Glass Joe. Yes, Glass Joe. With a record of 1-99, 1 win, 99 losses, he is everybody's favorite punching bag.
He hails from France, right?
Yes, he does. And he got stereotyped, to the moon in the Wii version of the game. But he wasn't, especially, stereotypical in Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. He was just, an unlucky guy with an unlucky name. And he was just fun to fight. And even though he always loses, he has become a Nintendo icon. So I feel like you really got to give it up for Glass Joe. He's a guy that, despite the odds, he always goes out there and tries to put up a fight.
Yeah, I mean, he's basically, as you mentioned, a human punching bag. And he really is kind of like a good taste of things to come. He literally is the first person you fight. So everyone has the experience of fighting Glass Joe, if you've ever played Punch-Out.
Yeah, totally. And, he was basically a tutorial before there were tutorials. So, Yeah, he is an unforgettable character indeed. Coming in at number four, we've got Piston Honda. He was the champion of the minor circuit. The thing I like about him is that he's just really balanced. He's not too tough, but he's not too easy. He has some interesting combo patterns, and it just makes for a really enjoyable battle.
Yeah, and you actually run into him twice, I believe,
yes,
in the game. An easy version and a hard version. And the hard version is much harder, for sure.
Yeah. He's the first opponent that you have to face in the world circuit.
So, yeah, so one interesting thing about Piston Honda was that, he really was one of the first characters that makes you have very precise timing.
Yeah.
You know, some of the other guys you can kind of get away with being a little loose. Him, when he comes rushing in, there's this one key moment where you can kind of give him a stomach jab, and he just goes down in one hit.
Oh, yeah. Or I thought sometimes a punch in the face would work, too. But, yeah, he does his little dance, then he comes down, you nail him, and he goes down. If you miss, though, then he, like, hits you with five punches in a row, and you're in real trouble there. But, yeah, that's one of the places where you're really taught the importance of blocking, because I think it's next to impossible to dodge those five punches. You have to be able to block those all in succession, and that is definitely a key thing to learn.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's a fun fight, and, earns you your first championship, and then he comes back, and you got to fight him later. So, yeah, he's just a fun character to do battle with.
I'm going to give you a TKO from Tokyo.
That's right. That's what he says. Okay, number three on the list, we have Super Macho Man.
Mm-hmm.
Hailing from Hollywood, California, he is the World Circuit Champion, and he is known for two things. A ridiculous spin punch that will knock you over in one hit, and laughing at you while shaking his man boobies.
He really does do that.
Yeah. And, it's just the rudest thing. It's very rude, and it makes him a great and memorable character. I've always been kind of curious about his hair, because I think he's supposed to actually be, like, a young, tanned guy.
Yeah.
But for some reason, he's got gray hair. I don't really understand. Maybe it's from staying out in the sun too long. I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's funny, because he also has, he shares a name with a professional wrestler, which is kind of funny
yes.
as well.
Yes, he does. Well, Macho Man anyway, not the super part, but yes, that is very true.
Right, I'm almost curious how that happened, if it was an intentional thing or not.
Well, it's interesting because in a lot of ways he kind of resembles Hulk Hogan. He was from Venice Beach, California. This guy's from Hollywood, California. They're not too far apart. So, yeah, I think there was definitely some, wrestling-style showmanship influence in Super Macho Man's character. I think it's probably not a coincidence.
Yeah, he's supposed to be age 27, but he looks like kind of an old man, to be frank.
Yep, he does. But even if he is, he's still very tough. So
my favorite thing about Super Macho Man is that he's rocking a mullet.
Well, is he? I saw his hair was just kind of slicked back.
I don't know. He's definitely, business in the front, party in the rear.
Yeah, definitely true. Can't argue with that.
I do have to say his taunt, as you mentioned, is one of the worst in the game. It really
by one of the worst, I mean one of the best.
Yeah, it makes you feel like quite an idiot for losing to him.
I actually thought it was pretty funny, which made him even harder, because it's tough enough mashing the buttons to recover from a knockdown, but doing it while you're cracking up because this guy's flexing his pecs makes it even harder. But yeah, he's an arrogant jerk, and that's why we like him. Okay, moving down the list, at number two comes the man hailing from the mysterious islands, King Hippo.
Yes.
We already talked about him before. He's got some very unique patterns you have to face. And, of course, he is also a multimedia superstar from his appearances in Captain N.
Yeah, he was a reoccurring bad guy on that show, right?
Oh, yeah, he was on every episode, yeah, where he was blue and had gigantic nipples for some reason. He wasn't really the greatest character on Captain N, but he was a fantastic character in Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. We already talked about the strategy they had to use, first hitting him in the mouth, then hitting him in the X in the belly, and just figuring that out or executing it was always very satisfying. And because of that, he's one of, certainly the most memorable characters in the game. Also, he just looked so weird,
Yeah.
He's from some place of unknown origin. He doesn't really look like a human. He's got a flipping crown on his head. He's just so weird.
He's a king.
Yeah. He's a king. We're not really sure what he's a king of, but...
There's a lot of fan art around him, and maybe more than any other Punch-Out character. And I love...
Like I said, he is a star.
And I love all of it. And then, you know, I also need to mention that in the Wii version, you fight a version of him with a manhole covering his belly.
Oh, is that when you fight him the second time?
Yeah. And he requires a little different strategy to get him down. But
I never fought that version. Very interesting.
Yeah, pretty cool.
All right, then. Moving on to number one. This is probably no surprise, but it's Mike Tyson. Mike Tyson himself. As we discussed earlier, he's sort of what made the game the success that it is. Still great without him, but you know, with him in there, obviously it just took it to a whole new level. I mean, you know, they tried to bring in Mr. Dream to replace him, and it just was not the same. You know, saying, oh, I beat, you know, some dude named Mr. Dream just doesn't have the same sort of impact as saying, I beat Mike Tyson, you know?
Yep. No, not even close. He really did kind of have this presence to the game that made it almost like legendary on the playground if you did beat him.
Yep, yep. Very, very true.
Before we totally wrap this thing up, Chris, I kind of wanted to give an honorable mention to one of my favorites from Mike Tyson's Punch-Out, and that's Bald Bull.
Ah, yes, Bald Bull. Yeah, I mean, I guess he comes in, you know, not quite in the top five, but he is certainly one of the most memorable characters. I suppose the reason that he did not make our list is because that I hate fighting him. And you hate fighting him, right?
I do hate fighting him. He was definitely my, like, the bane of my existence when I played this game when I was younger.
Yeah, he gave me a lot of trouble, too.
Yeah, he'd give me fits, and I'd always get stuck on him. I could never get the timing right of his bull charge. Mm-hmm. And, of course, before YouTube, you had to, like, actually see someone do it in order to know what the timing was.
I mean, even now, I can't do it 100% of the time. I've knocked him out so many times, you think I would have it down to a perfect science now. But no, there are still times now when I mess up and he knocks me to the floor.
He still gets me.
Yeah, so for being such a big jerk, he did not make our top five. But yes, I guess he does deserve at least honorable mention.
Absolutely.
Anyway, it's been 30 years as of this month that Mike Tyson's Punch-Out hit the NES. There are a lot of games that have come out in that time that people have totally forgotten about, but Mike Tyson's Punch-Out is not one of them. It is still just as fun now as it was back then.
Yes, but that doesn't mean that I don't want to see another Punch-Out at some point, Chris.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think there's still more of this franchise. I mean, we've only had three different versions on console so far. And, yeah, I think they could certainly do more with another game. And, hey, you know, Mike Tyson seems a lot more favorable again. Maybe they could bring him back, you think?
I don't know. The face tattoo kind of turns people off.
Yeah, I think the chances of that happening are slim and none. But I would love it if they actually you know, did start working with him again, because it would be really cool to have this particular version back on you know, Virtual Console or NES Classic or something like that. But anyway, you look at it, going down history as one of the all-time greats.
Yeah, you're totally right, Chris.
All right, I think that takes care of this week's big topic, which means it's time to wrap up the episode. However, before we go, we do have time for one more thing, and that is, of course, a dramatic reading.
Bum, bum, bum.
Once again, continuing the adventures of Captain Nintendo from the pages of Nintendo Power, Volume 4. Previously, Nintendo employee Brett Randles paused his Metroid game and became Captain Nintendo when he was caught in an explosion at Nintendo HQ. The incident also caused Mother Brain and Ganon to come to life, but Captain Nintendo fought Ganon to a standstill using his light controlling powers. And now, the saga continues. All right, you two. That will be quite enough. Captain Nintendo looked up to see Morgana O'Fay, Nintendo's top receptionist, descending the stairway which led into the reception area. I'm the one responsible for this area, and I won't stand for any roughhousing in here, scolded Morgana. Take it outside where it belongs. Where it belongs, that's it, said Captain Nintendo to himself. Sorry, Morgana, he said, redirecting his attention. This, they, it. Oh, Brett, it's you, shouted Morgana, getting a closer look. She had maintained a world-class crush on Brett for some time now, though she never let him suspect it. I didn't recognize. Say, nice threads. I really like the boots, but I'd put, like, a big S on the chest, or a bat. and over here I'd try one of those. Morgana, I'd like to stay and chat, but I'm sort of in the middle of something, and you've just given me an idea. Me? But I... Brett, did you injure that thing permanently? Asked Terra, still attending to Max, who was starting to come around. I think he's only blinded temporarily, Cap answered, which means we've got to work fast. You and Morgana stay here and help Max and Zelda. I'll be back very soon. As he turned to go, he could see that Zelda, frozen with fear, looked like a mannequin, oblivious to everything. Hang in there, princess, he thought. I'm going to get you the best kind of help from where it belongs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what does that mean? What could it possibly mean? Where would you be getting help from where it belongs? We don't know.
We don't know.
Nope. We'll just have to wait and see what he means in an upcoming episode of this exciting saga of Captain Nintendo versus Mother Brain and Ganon.
Well, kids, we're still accepting submissions for this fan fiction that we requested a couple weeks ago.
That you requested, your crazy Hoff versus Pete fan fiction story.
Well, yes. I figure it might be interesting. So we have some submissions. There's still time, but I think it might be next week we'll be reading this one, or at least Hoffman will be reading it.
Yeah. We'll probably have a winner chosen and read on our next show. That's the target anyway. And with that in mind, I think that does it for this week. As always, you can find us at powerpros.podbean.com, and you can follow us at PowerProsPod on both Facebook and Twitter. You can follow me, The Hoff, on Twitter at ChrisTheHoff, and you can find Pete at BurlyRedYeti. You can email us at powerprospod@gmail.com, and of course, if you like the podcast, we'd appreciate it if you would give us a rating on iTunes. Thanks for listening, everybody. For myself, Pete Michaud,
I'll always be your one-up girl,
and Super Macho Man,
it's showtime!
We will see you next time.